Chief, if I were surrounded by 6 or 8 of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
Well, there's no problem. If you had a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them. If you don't, get yourself a club or a torch. Beat them or burn them. They go up pretty easy.
The Pseudopod Autopsy, 1408. Fundamentally, horror should be the least popular fiction genre in history. After all, every other story type out there is about getting something. Boy gets girl, girl gets Juilliard scholarship, man gets to moon, or man gets to realize that his old life was an empty shell, Liv Tyler is a much better actress than Jennifer Lopez, and that he's actually got everything he possibly needs, working for the borough council with his dad in New Jersey. Yes, that's right, I'm the other Jersey Girl fan. But stack horror up against that, and what do you get? Subtraction. Every other genre is about adding things, about merrily tramping along Campbell's hero's journey to Oz, or the Death Star, or Kaiser Soze's real identity, whichever. Horror, however, is about taking things away. Lives, loved ones, limbs, souls. Horror takes away what we already had, where every other genre is about giving it back to us, often with something more for our trouble. So why do we like it? Simple. It's like standing on a cliff edge and making a conscious choice not to jump off. Like staring into the Nietzschean abyss, sucking your teeth and going, that looks a bit dark. It's the same reason people slow down at car crashes. The same reason people who are afraid of heights ride roller coasters. The same reason why we tell ghost stories. Because as a species, there is nothing we like better than seeing how far we can walk away from the campfire before we get scared. Horror is the only genre that has an inherent challenge to it, the only genre that grabs us by the lapels and dares us to do something about what frightens us. It's shock therapy in fictional form. And to deploy the world's most obvious segue, Stephen King is a perfect example of how this works. King has scaled Olympus, becoming one of those authors who are simply that. Authors. Not horror or science fiction or romance authors, just authors. His books are read everywhere, sold everywhere. His tales of human failing, of pain and death and terror, have been read by millions upon millions of people for almost as long as I've been alive. It's odd, then, that movie versions of King's stories have had, to be fair, a spotty past. Now, I will put my hand up to being as fond of Maximum Overdrive as the next guy, and the TV version of It had such a profound effect on my consistently wonderful wife that the phrase "everything floats down here" is still used as a default example of the ultimate in sinister in the Stewart household. But for every It, there's a Dark Half. For every Needful Things, which is incredibly good fun, by the way, if you've not seen it, there's a Sometimes They Come Back for More yet again. There seems to be very little middle ground with King adaptations. They're either great or visual dentistry. There's no in-between. 1408, directed by Lasse Hafström, is quite definitely in the first camp. The pathologically excellent John Cusack stars as Mike Enslin, a professional parapsychology writer who specializes in cheerfully tabloid haunted travel guides. From the top 10 haunted hotel rooms to the top 10 haunted graveyards, Mike travels America equipped with EM meters, night vision cameras, crime lights, his trusty tape recorder, and an increasingly world-weary and cynical outlook. And he finds absolutely nothing. Mike has stayed in beds where people have died, spent the night in graveyards that others won't go anywhere near, and he's never experienced so much as a bump in the night. Until, that is, he gets an unsigned postcard from the Dolphin Hotel in New York. The message on the back reads simply, "Do not enter 1408. And just like that, Mike Enslin is hooked. He badgers and bullies and cajoles, until finally he becomes the first person to stay in room 1408 in 11 years. A room where over 20 people have been killed, where a further 50 have died, a room that the staff of the hotel are so terrified of, they will not go in alone and will not let the door be shut whilst they're in there. Mike Enslin, professional cynic, versus the most haunted room in New York City. Like the Carpenters once sung, we've only just begun." Hafström, along with scriptwriters Matt Greenberg, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, instantly stacks the deck in their favour in two very clear ways. Firstly, the script is easily one of the best King adaptations in years, neatly balancing the reveals on Mike's past and the threat to his present, with some beautifully handled visuals. Hafström's camera, in particular, is a constantly roving, cautious presence in 1408, often observing Cusack from the middle distance, as though it was a presence within the room. There's a sense, after a while, that the camera, and by extension the audience, are actually a personification of the room, watching Mike in the same way that a lion watches its prey. It's a nervous, tense, voyeuristic way of shooting the film that ratchets up the unease without once resorting to MTV cutting or shrieky music. In fact, there's a single cheap scare in the film, a hammer-wielding maniac, played by Cusack's friend and Grosse Pointe Blank sparring partner, legendary kickboxer Benny the Jet Urquidez, and it seems distinctly out of place when it arrives, as the vast majority of everything else you see is far subtler, far more insidiously horrifying than that. The film's biggest asset, however, is Cusack. Very few actors have matured and improved as much as Cusack has, and he has that unique everyman quality that so many leading men strive for and so few achieve. He's cocky, sarcastic, clearly very smart, and also horribly damaged, and from the moment the film hits the ground, the end result is a uniquely nuanced and honest main character. Mike Enslin is a modern-day Houdini, a man channeling the anger he feels at the way his life has turned out into all-out war with the supernatural. It's inevitable, then, that sooner or later, the supernatural would decide to strike back. Which brings us to the other main character in the film, 1408 itself. King has always excelled in finding both the horror in mundanity and the mundanity in horror, and here that reaches its absolute peak. In a speech translated almost verbatim from the short story, Mike comments on how hotel rooms are designed to feel familiar, safe, but in reality are anything but. After all, how many people slept in the room's bed before you did? How many people died in the room's bed before you slept there? This idea of something awful just under the normal world is perfectly demonstrated by the film's best scene. With the lights out, Mike makes his way around 1408, shining his crime light on every surface. And every single surface is covered in blood. As each stain appears, just for a second, we see the person who died there. Blood and fitted cushions, agony and madness and complimentary mints. This perversion of the mundane lies at the heart of 1408 as it uses every item in the room and in Mike's mind to drive him mad. From the digital alarm clock by the bed to the increasingly sinister anonymous receptionist, the message the room sends is clear. You're alone, and if you're supremely lucky, you'll be allowed to die. What really makes this shine, however, is the sense of humour the room clearly possesses. One of the film's best sequences sees Mike edge along the window ledge to the next room along, only for it to extend cartoon-like away from him. Later, he finds every window is bricked up, turns to the fire exit map and sees it's completely black, apart from 1408 in its centre. And in the centre of 1408 is an arrow leading to a sign that says, "You are here." This sort of casual, offhand horror is neatly balanced by the victims of the room. The film has been criticised in some quarters for the appearance of several previous inhabitants as ghosts, and whilst they're far from the film's subtlest moments, their appearance, as flickering film images, neatly emphasises the horrific history of 1408. In fact, the second hour embraces this idea of the past and present colliding. Without giving too much away, the script uses this concept to pull the rug out from both the viewer and the hapless Mike's feet, not once, but twice. Nothing is certain, nothing is safe, and this soon becomes a film as much about the perversion of reality by an outside force as it is about a man trapped in a hotel room. Whilst the script sensibly focuses on the war between Mike and 1408, three other characters play small but vital roles. Mary McCormack is in many ways the female equivalent of Cusack, an actress whose natural authority and intelligence raises any film she's in. 1408 is no exception, and her presence as Lily, Mike's wife, grounds both Mike and the film immeasurably. She's almost the control character, someone whose life has been touched by the same tragedy as Mike's, but someone who has, somehow, managed to move on. It's a difficult role, with none of the snarky charm that Cusack couldn't fall back on, but McCormack gives it, and the film, exactly the emotional weight needed. Jasmine Jessica Antony, as their daughter Katie, has even less screen time and even more to do in it. She's less a character, more a memory, a hint of Mike and Lily's past life that serves to demonstrate what Mike's lost, and what he has the potential to regain. It's an almost impossible role to pull off, but Antony manages it, and the scenes where the three of them are together as a family are as natural and affecting as they are brief. Somewhat inevitably, though, the member of the supporting cast who really stands out is Samuel L. Jackson. As hotel manager Mr. Olin, Jackson is urbane, well-educated, courteous, and honestly and openly terrified. He's on screen barely 15 minutes, and most of those are in a wonderfully sparky exchange with Cusack. Olin is, in many ways, the final chance Mike has to escape, the final opportunity for him to turn away, and Jackson's open fear of 1408 is one of the most chilling elements of the film. His description of how the room is turned, once a month, by maids working in pairs, speaks volumes not only about how dangerous it is, but about how the rumour has come to dominate his life. It's clear, although he never says it out loud, that he thinks about that one day in the month constantly, that he builds his life around it, that he copes with horror on an everyday basis. Horror in mundanity, and mundanity in horror, once again. 1408 is in many ways a willfully old-fashioned horror movie, favouring subversion over dissection. Dripping with menace and atmosphere, it's a story about facing up to your demons before they face up to you, and about what happens when you get absolute, unequivocal proof of something you've always wanted to believe. And as the old saying goes, be careful what you wish for.
Well, that's pretty hard to say. We don't know how many of them there are. We know when we find them, we can kill them.
Are they slow-moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.